We appreciate very much their being with us and sharing fellowship with us. And now we very much appreciate the privilege of being served by Brother Jerry. And I don't need to give you the discourse title because it's right in front of you, Philippians 2:14. So we're looking very much forward to listening to what Brother Jerry has to bring to us from the Lord's great storehouse. Brother Jerry.
Thank you, Brother Randall. A few messages up front may be appropriate. Our class in Portland, Oregon, of course, wished their love and greetings sent, which they voted to do, and also sent the text in Isaiah 33, verse 6, as a greetings to this convention and to you. We also have special greetings from several brethren in the Northwest area that especially asked their love to be brought, the Ostranders, the Schroeders, the Andruses, the Kirkhams, and if you know those brethren, they especially wanted their love brought. Also, we lost one of our deacons on Monday, died, Brother John Knapp, and we will leave a void in the class. And our prayers and would ask for yours on behalf of Sister Ruth, his wife. On the table over on this wall, we have left some photographs of our recent trip to Romania, Ukraine, and Moldova. And I'm very happy to see my traveling companion and translator at this convention. It's a real blessing to see Brother Christian. We want to thank our son and daughter for transport to this convention from Columbus, and also are grateful for the open home at the Kramers at Wes and Tony's. Do all things without murmurings and disputings. We're glad that you had a very good foundation for this late last evening, and we will overlap a little, but not too much. I feel that that was a very good review and focusing our minds on the subject last evening. At first reading, this may appear a rather routine admonition, one which may have only little application to our own situation, one which we may benefit by some improvement, yet are willing to tolerate some leniency in others and ourselves without great consequence. But that is only the apparent first reading. That is not the case, and we hope that our words today are not too discouraging. In fact, along the lines of discouragement, we may have a few words later in the lesson. But let us look at the real meaning of the words, at the weight of the context, and the historical examples and precedent, and some of the consequences of this admonition. The two words are murmur and dispute. It is interesting that these two words are combined in a single admonition, and they are found, the word murmur is found in two very similar words, Strong's number in the Greek, 1111 and 1112. And it's basically the thought of grudging, secret, displeasure, mutter, mumble, and grumble. And the word dispute comes from the Greek words 1260 and 1261, having the meaning of doubtful reasoning, doubt, quarrel, to take issue, debate, fault-finding. And as we found out last night, its root meaning is simple reasoning, the logical relationship. But in this context, it is the contention, the debate aspect. The first of these two words, murmuring, falls under the category of the unwilling, weak, and yet stubborn spirit, the spirit not willing to confront issues in plain language. The muttering, the mumbling, yet always complaining of the inequity from others, and therefore preoccupied with self-focus, rights, and our desires. It means to be disappointed or dissatisfied with our environment, with our circumstances in life, in which the Lord, in His love and mercy, has placed us. Therefore, it is really a moral issue. The second word, dispute, is really an intellectual rebellion of God. It is a more advanced nature of the first, though it is often rationalized as only against our fellow man. It objects with a measure of logic, to accuse, a tendency to dissent and distrust, to justify self, to doubt and question God's providences. One who has a controversy with most every teaching, practice, and personal conduct is a disputer. Let us look at the New Testament use of these words. First, we will compare John chapter 6. John 6:41 to 43. The Jews were therefore grumbling about him because he said, "I am the bread that came down from heaven." And they were saying, "Is not this Jesus, the son of Joseph, whose father and mother we know? How does he now say, 'I have come down from heaven'?" Jesus answered and said to them, "Do not grumble among yourselves." You see, they murmured or complained at Jesus' claim to have come from heaven. At this point, it is not a matter of clear understanding or evidence or even debate on their part. But because they didn't want to believe, their only recourse is to grumble. It was an attitude that overflowed into words and conduct. Jesus continued to open the deep things of the Word to those who were listening, that unless they ate His flesh and drank His blood, they had no life in them. This is further down in the chapter, verses 54 to 66. Here also, some murmured, some turned away, some walked no more with him. It was a reproach. The cost was too much. But for a few, like Peter, their answer was, "Lord, to whom shall we go? Thou hast the words of eternal life." Again, we turn to another example in Matthew 20. Matthew 20, verse 11 and 12. Verse 11. "And when they received it, they grumbled at the landowner, saying, 'These last men have worked only 1 hour, and you have made them equal to us, who have borne the burden and the scorching heat of the day.'" In this parable, they thought the householder was not capable of running his own harvest work and were dissatisfied with the ways and means which he thought best and wise to employ. They complain against those who labored later. This is a weak appeal to receive more for themselves, even more than they had agreed to. They were ready to complain about the payment to others with a view to self-promotion. When did the murmuring come in this parable? Perhaps as a warning to us who also live in the evening of the day. It is in the evening to those who live in the end of this gospel age day. It was not that they did not have enough or what they agreed upon and expected. It was murmuring against others that they should be honored equally. When we see others with as much or more than us, we desire more for ourselves. Our day is marked by discontent. The more we have, the more we want. And never do we seem to get enough. It is our observation in our travels in Eastern Europe that those with less have a greater contentment than those with more of this world's goods. They find the greatest joy in spiritual bounties. And since the temporal is so little, it is of little consequence anyway. In fact, it is our concern as more and more of the Western affluence and abundance migrates east. The brethren will have to struggle with this, as do we. It is our observation that most discontent arises by seeing others with more and allowing a measure of envy to arise. Others seem to have good health, and I've lost mine. Others have economic opportunity, and I have to scratch for every dollar to make ends meet. Others have warm, supporting family, and I've lost mine. But the abundance of their life is an illusion. Every Christian must feel the necessity and deprivation of his life if we are to center our affections on heavenly things. Most of us see only what others seem to have and see not of what they are deprived. And this is true even among brethren. We often don't expose the heartache and the pains, the deprivation and the suffering. Perhaps it is good we don't. But let's not believe the illusion of what we may see on the outside. And let us bear with one another. If bread has been given us and our water is assured, what more should we ask for of temporal goods? There is another kind of murmuring against the difficulties of the way. We knew it would be difficult at first, but then we became accustomed to many common comforts, to the norms of this life and this world. And we have an anxious pulse when they are taken away. In John 53 to 66, Jesus began to open the deep things of his word to those who were listening. Unless they ate his flesh and drank his blood, they had no part with him. This is a hard saying. Who can bear it? This is difficult, hard to comprehend. Why? Look at the reproaches it will bring. Look at the disturbances it will make in our life and how it will reverse our relation with our friends and our neighbors. They do not like the reproach. Remember Paul's exhortation? Let us go forth to him without the camp bearing his reproach. Oh, they could not stand to bear his reproach, to be associated with him in the ignominy and shame. Reproach of what? The reproach of the cross of Christ was a burden. Our Lord was made of no reputation. And who wants to be associated with those who have no reputation? But he was loyal to the Heavenly Father's will. And few could appreciate this standard. They said he had a devil. Jesus knew that his disciples murmured, but he said, "Doth it also offend you?" The same spirit of discontent eating at their very hearts began to manifest itself under the severity of the tests that were coming upon them. As it is written, "There are some of you who believe not." From this time forth, many of his disciples went back and walked not with him. "You shall all be offended because of me this night." Of the people, there was none with him, and only the 12 remained. Where were the 4 or the 5 or the 7,000? The multitudes that hung around, hungry upon his words, where were they now? Did some murmur? Another parallel context, 1 Corinthians 10, verse 10. The 10th verse. "Nor grumble as some of them did, and were destroyed by the destroyer." Here the illustration is being used in connection with Numbers, the 12th, 14th, and 16th chapters. Numbers 12, 14, and 16. Particularly in Numbers 12, the first two verses, 1 and 2. "Then Miriam and Aaron spoke against Moses because of the Cushite woman whom he had married. For he had married a Cushite woman. And they said, 'Has the Lord indeed spoken only through Moses? Has he not spoken through us as well?' And the Lord heard it." You know, this marriage question is a very serious one. It is always more serious with the other fellow than with the one who gets married, as you probably noticed. Nevertheless, marriage seems to be at the bottom of this particular incident. Miriam and Aaron were displeased with the fact, first of all, that Moses had married at all. Secondly, that he was foolish enough to marry without consulting the wishes of the family. And additionally, to marry an Ethiopian woman. And they murmured against him. And that was not, but that was not the secret of their murmuring, dear friends. That was not the particular thing that was eating like a cancer in their hearts. They murmured, "Hath the Lord spoken only by Moses?" That was the real issue. But notice this, "Hath he not also spoken by us?" There is where the real attitude of their hearts began to manifest itself. "And the Lord heard it." In this, Miriam suffered the leprous consequences. Numbers 14, 1 and 2. "Then all the congregation lifted up their voices and cried, and the people wept that night. And all the sons of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron. And the whole congregation said unto them, 'Would that we had died in the land of Egypt, or would that we had died in this wilderness.'" Complaining against the providences of God, even in necessities, is there at the heart of this, at the heart of this murmuring? Sometimes the Lord answers our complaint in such a way that we wish we had not asked so presumptuously. The Israelites were sickened by the answer. But the Lord answered. He was forbearing with them. In all of this, brethren, we see that the murmuring should not lead to self-sufficiency. The Lord spoke by us. We don't need his words. We are sufficient. Or, "What I have been given is not sufficient. Lord, give me something of my own definition." Numbers 16. I'm just going to read verses 3 and 41. Numbers 16, verse 3. "They gathered themselves together against Moses and against Aaron and said to them, 'Ye take too much upon you, seeing all the congregation are holy, even every one of them, and the Lord is among them. Wherefore then lift ye up yourselves above the congregation of the Lord.'" 41. "But on the next day, All the congregation of the sons of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron, saying, "You are the ones who have caused the death of the Lord's people." This was a rebellion led by the high princes of Israel. One of them was Korah, the son of Ishar, with whom was associated 250 princes, men of renown. It was the princes and elders who, allowing the spirit of pride and ambition to spring in their hearts and bring forth the bitter fruitage of murmuring and dissatisfaction. It began with complaints. Complaints about the authority of Moses and Aaron, which incidentally were appointed by the Lord. And it ended with blame for the death of the rebels. Notice the rationale for the complaint. All the congregation is holy, but you take too much upon yourselves. Within every complaint, there is the desire to blame, to find a scapegoat for self-vindication. But even deeper is the purpose of self-promotion at another's expense. Well, perhaps murmuring is not such a trivial matter after all, is it? But like all the ways of the flesh, it does not begin with great ostentation. It finds a voice in the little affairs of life. Later, after assuming a natural home in our conduct, it later becomes bolder at every turn. In all of this, there is perhaps the suggestion to accept the Lord's ways. Accept the message and messengers he has appointed. Respect and honor the ways he has directed our lives, and not to presume too much for ourselves. Now, what of disputing? This is the second word used in this text. This is doubtful reasoning or fault-finding, as we said. This goes beyond even chronic complaining. It has now moved into intellectual defense of a wrong. The word is also found in Romans 14, verse 1. Romans 14, 1. "Him that is weak in the faith receive ye, but not to doubtful disputations." The thought is that he that is new and weak or sick in the faith to receive with gentle consideration. Do not come down upon him with an interrogation, accusations, confrontations, challenges, and intimidation. This speaks of taking a weaker one to task and to reprimand him or contend and argue with that his conduct and perhaps even his motives are wrong. Often our disputing with another is to really exonerate ourselves more than to correct the ways of our brother. If our motive is to correct the ways of our brother, we will do it with gentleness and reasonableness and with love. Another example is found in Luke chapter 5, verse 21. Luke 5, 21. "The scribes and the Pharisees began to reason," and this is the word, "to reason, saying, who is this man who speaks blasphemies? Who can forgive sins but God alone?" The word reason is the same word dispute. This was more than reasoning as we would think of it in the reasonable sense, but contention with an air of logical contention. Who can forgive sins but God alone? Logical statement. Therefore, Jesus had no right. Therefore, his work was blasphemy in their dispute. They overlooked the authority by which he forgave sins, and they sought to discredit his conduct. But notice Jesus' answer in verse 22. Why are you reasoning, again, disputing in your hearts? This was more than a matter of lips. Ah, here is where the problem begins, in the heart. Matthew 15, verse 19, Jesus says, "For out of the heart come evil thoughts." Evil thoughts. Those two words are the same Greek word, number 1261, disputings. Evil thoughts. Murders, adulteries, fornications, theft, false witness, slanders. These are the things which defile a man. The corresponding Hebrew word is the Hebrew Strong's number 3198, and occurs frequently in the book of Job concerning the arguments, the accusations, the disputes of the so-called comforters against Job. Notice those extensive arguments were to blame Job. They were not really to comfort him. They wanted to accuse him. They involved long intellectual reasoning designed to expose his guilt. But notice how God dismisses all those disputers with a single question in Job 38, verse 2. Who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge? It was not specially the issue of sin that God was trying to impose upon Job, but the lesson of absolute submission, dependency under duress. It was this experience that ultimately enabled Job to perform the role of a mediator for his very tormentors in the end. What are you being developed for? To be part of the mediator class. For those in which we have largely lived and suffered in this world. Who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge? I think he was addressing the so-called comforters and their contentions. It was not especially the issue of sin, as we have said, but submission. Sometimes what we propose as counsel is simply heaping our determined judgments of dispute upon another. We feel vindicated in our own reasoning and walk away in the free air of superiority. But is there any lingering question of what has really troubled our companion? Was there any element of truth in his position? Have we really given him the material to stand straighter and stronger and taller? Are we in any way subject to his own weaknesses ourselves? Let us help one another, first of all, considering our own weakness. When God shows his reasoning, he says, "Come, let us reason together. Though your sins be as scarlet, they shall be white as snow." He shows us a way through our undone condition, but to not stand only in judgment. Brethren, we are not saying that we should turn from every defense of the truth, or on the other hand, declare that every doctrinal interpretation and practice is just as justifiable and reasonable as another. That is not so. That all things should be equally called good. Jesus openly declared the hypocrisy of the Pharisees. Paul withstood Peter to the face on the issue of the Jewish law and the treatment of the Gentiles. But how they did this is of utmost importance. Was it with personal vindictiveness? Was it with a view of intimidating the other? or with manners and methods that could turn them to the truth. For those that we've had some fellowship with in years past, know our own position in supporting the second volume chronology, and particularly the events that mark the beginning of the Gentile times. And I hope that you know that it is not with a desire to impugn the motives of those who differ, but to explore the beauty and harmony of the given chronology and prophecies. Should we sever our dialogue with others? Should we declare ourselves loyal and others wayward? Such is the furthest from our minds. We wish to let the Lord be the judge of such things which we cannot read. Truth can be our goal without sitting in the court against the motives of those who differ. Now, we might still persist that we already avoid these disputing methods, but let us look at the words of Philippians 2:14 again. Do all things without murmuring and disputing. What are the all things? We say we would not do so in a testimony meeting. Certainly not in the fellowship at our meetings or at a convention. But what about a business meeting? Do we posture ourselves and position ourselves and others, exonerating self and laying responsibility at the feet of another? Or do we simply state the scripture principles as we find them and allow each to use these as they see best, merely inquiring how we can work together closer in the Word and His Spirit? But what about the home? Shouldn't we have the opportunity to at least hear, voice our grievances, our contentions toward our children and mates? We say we would not speak so among the brethren, but at least our family should be a sounding board for our grievances, and such conversations will not go beyond the home. Most things that we practice, however, brethren, and devise in the home are practiced with only a little more delicacy in the wider arenas of life. Let us practice the principles in the smallest affairs and places of our lives, and then we will find ourselves more responsible in the bigger arenas. Or even more subtle are the little comments of either murmuring or dispute. They are so routine and minor, most would never even register what is transacting. Others only feel the weight of our words. Here's an example. A friend is struggling or inconvenienced with a little matter while we are standing by and watching. And after they've struggled with this, we respond, "Why didn't you ask me for some help?" In those few words, we have put the responsibility of their trouble on themselves for not asking. We have relieved ourselves of anticipating or hastening to their assistance because they did not choose to ask. Oh, it is so subtle. Silence is usually the only reply, as that friend is already coping with his little trouble. Now he is asked to admit that if he had only asked you, he would not be in this predicament. Example 2. Someone in a class, or even a family member, is given a task or an opportunity for service. A week later, we have had no report. So we ask, "Have you followed through with that matter?" Or, "If you can't do that, perhaps someone else should take the responsibility." The message is simply that you have judged that they have not followed through, or that they are irresponsible, and that somehow you are very clear about these matters. is only a few words. But anticipate how your hearer receives them. Brethren, if you bite and devour one another, take care lest you be consumed by one another. Galatians 5:15. We bite and devour by first setting ourselves up as the judges of others' conducts and motives. Second, we do it by contending that their position is indefensible. This is not only with words, even more subtle, it is with looks and with body language. A cold greeting or handshake signals a grievance of something past. A lack of attention to a brother's words, a shrug of the shoulders, a turning away, a look of contempt or arrogance, a curl of the mouth. The tone of your voice and the look in your eye can injure just as severely as a slap in the face or a spit in the eye. Yes, there are times that neglect of the feelings of another can lend to some misinterpreted relations. But these are usually not so serious as those which we either subconsciously plan or use as defense or even practice in our course of self-preservation at the expense of others. If we respond to an elder's lesson which unsettles our preferred views with, "Who set him up as our teacher? He takes too much authority on himself." Are we any better than Korah in our encouraging others to rebel? It's the same lesson. What is the proper course in all of these matters? First, it is true that others may indeed be caught in some error. But even here, Paul says in Galatians 6, verse 1, "Brethren, if a man is caught in any trespass, you who are spiritual, restore such a one in the spirit of gentleness, each one looking to yourself, lest you too be tempted." And again in Hebrews 12, verse 12 and 13, he says, Paul says, "Therefore strengthen the hands that are weak and the knees that are feeble, and make straight paths for your feet, so that the limb which is lame may not be put out of joint, but rather be healed." What is he saying? First of all, consider yourself. We are sure we are not weak or tempted in the same direction in which we regard another, are we? Are we sure that we may not have some of the same weaknesses of those whom we criticize? Then remember that our mission is not to judge or punish. It is to restore. And that is quite different. And to recover. How can this be done? It can only be done with gentleness, love, truth, inspiration, motivation, example, creating opportunity, companionship with mission and vision. Otherwise, we create a defensive atmosphere. This defensiveness and antagonism has divided brethren and also families for ages. If truth and its spirit be our goal, let these also be our guardian of our lips. But once we have practiced cynical attitudes, practice disputing of doctrines, interpretations, and conduct, it is not so easy to change. It is like tobacco or drug dependencies. We may reason with ourselves that it is not really a problem, or that the problem is very small, or even that we could change if there were really a need to change. But change is never effective by nursing an ailment. A radical decision must be made to sever the offending limb of ourselves. Our text begins with one of the smallest words in the English language, do. It suggests a positive decision and commitment. Nike Corporation coined the phrase, just do it. Here is commitment. There is no compromise with the flesh, no painless transition, no transformation without the renewing of the mind. Just decide to do all things without murmuring and disputing. Only then can some medicines and treatments begin to heal. Otherwise, the medicine is only considered a vain philosophy like medical quackery. But let's assume we all decide to neither murmur or repine at what the Lord's providences permit, and not to injuriously dispute with those we would really help in this narrow way. Now, there are some remedies that we can apply to the healing process, but it begins with decisiveness. But medicine is no good unless you are intent upon the cure. First, consider the welfare of your hearer. If you have a difference, are you first interested in declaring your righteousness or recovering their vision and values? If the latter, then you will be less inclined to simply declare their mistakes and more inclined to shed light on their path. If they walk in it, and even if they declare it is their discovery rather than your information, we will even the more rejoice that the light is now part of their identity, whether you are recognized as the giver or not. It matters not, because we were concerned about their recovery. And we need not the credit. We call this altruism, or altruistic. The antonym is egoistic, or egoism. Altruism is the unselfish concern for the welfare of others. This leads to a second remedy. If our concern is first for them, then anticipate how they will respond and feel to what we say, not how we would respond. We already know that. But the fact that there is a difference implies a different mindset. It is this that we want to modify for the better, or at least understand and accept where they are without further contention. If they are likely to only be defensive, conceive how to present the matter that will invite their consideration. Is this really so hard? We can say, well, brother, I happen to differ with you. Or, you cannot justify that view based on these scriptures. Or, if you believe that, you must not understand these other doctrines. Is it so hard to anticipate the response? Isn't there going to be justification and defensiveness triggered from the outset? Is it not more productive to ask, how do you understand these scriptures? Or, how does this position contribute to our greater harmony and understanding of God's plan? In that other little matter, we may have said, did you follow through with your responsibility? On the other hand, we might say, did you have the opportunity to check on that request? What is the likely response from these two kind of comments? It's not so difficult to anticipate what the difference will be. The one will be defensiveness and justification, and the other will invite reasoning. These methods can apply to both the little annoyances and the major issues of our Christian walk. Hebrews 10, verse 24. Let us consider how to stimulate one another to love and good deeds. Certainly it is the truth that will do this, but it is also the spirit of the truth. Another rule to consider is first to listen before you criticize. Understand before you prescribe. Much murmuring and disputing is done on impulse. We think we know what another has said and meant. But first listen. Be sure you heard what they said. After that, check your understanding of what they meant. If not, make sincere inquiry until you can repeat their case to their satisfaction. Only then are you prepared to have a rational dialogue. Only then are you prepared to trust your prescription for them. Until then, you cannot be sure that you are not missing the mark. You know, all these issues of murmuring and dispute have to do with differences of preference, convenience, and wants. We hear children cry out, "Why do I always have to give in? Why do others change my plan? He always gets his way, and I look like the bad guy. Why do I have to do it? Let the other guy take the responsibility sometimes." You hear this from children. Fortunately, in a little more sophisticated words that come out of our own mouths. But brethren, as adult Christians, we have mature resources. We can be part of the solution. We can listen, we can dialogue, suggest, lead the example, set down the truth in a clear and defensible fashion without being contentious. But none of these will be effective unless we have a bigger yes in our life. It is very hard just to say no to all these problem areas and say, go away, do away with it, put it down. Just don't do these things. Life does not allow for voids. Saying no to these offensive negatives will only be successful when we have a bigger yes. The yes of Jesus' example and mission before our eyes. When we consider him the author and finisher of our faith. This must fill our vision. I want to conclude with a brief consideration of the next two verses. This Paul offers as the reason why we should not murmur and dispute. In Philippians 2:15-16. That ye may prove yourselves to be blameless and innocent children of God, above reproach in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation, among whom ye appear as lights in the world, holding fast the word of life, so that in the day of Christ I may have cause to glory, because I did not run in vain, nor toil in vain. The meaning is clear. It is safest to keep guard against every snare of the flesh and adversary. This is so that we do not give occasion to those so ensnared in the world to blame the message and light that you bear. We are ambassadors for the kingdom message. Let it not be blamed. Can you practice a morose, vindictive, complaining, argumentative manner and still expect our hearers to give heed to our message? On the contrary, a noble, reverent, submissive life will be the kind of vessel that none will gainsay. Let it be said of us, as of Daniel, we shall not find any ground of accusation against this Daniel unless we find it against him with regard to the law of his God. Daniel 6:5. Let us be transparent vessels for the light we bear. I said I would try to find a few words against discouragement. Every one of us fight these syndromes and symptoms in our lives, in our flesh. The question was asked yesterday, can any of us totally abstain from murmuring and disputing? We should. And then it was said, this is our target, this is our goal. And I want to appreciate that. We are not condemning ourselves or you because we sometimes fail. We have the goal, the desire in our heart to do better. And that's the emphasis of this lesson, the desire to improve. I have a few cards here that there's 20 or so, and I'd be glad to share them with you. On one side is the 12 salient points from reprint 3593, with a little list of highlighted points that Brother Russell makes about helpful hints for daily life. Excellent points, and I keep one of these with me as a little reminder, and I'd be glad to share them with you. On the back is the original morning resolve. It was a very simple thing that is nice and easy to commit to memory and is a good checkpoint at some of these turns in our life. And pull these things out of memory is very good sometimes. But these 12 points, if you don't carry this card, read the article, 3593. I have about 20 of them here. Now let's listen to the last few words of Paul. Because I did not run in vain, can we say, dear brother Paul, your words and advice are not forgotten. You have not toiled on our behalf in vain. On our behalf, the feet members, you have not explained these things and fallen on deaf ears. Finally, listen to the seal of Paul's commitment in verses 17 and 18. But even if I am being poured out as a drink offering upon the sacrifice and service of your faith, I rejoice and share my joy with you all. And you too, I urge you, rejoice in the same way and share your joy with me. Let our lives be poured out with and upon each other's sacrifice as a sweet libation that we might receive the joyful end of our faith. Let it be said of us, as Paul regarded the Corinthians, in 2 Corinthians 3, verse 2 and 3, ye are our epistle written in our hearts, known and read of all men, for as much as ye are manifestly declared to be the epistle of Christ, ministered by us, written not with ink, but with the Spirit of the living God, not in tables of stone, but in the fleshly tables of the heart.
Thank you, Brother Jerry, for your very stimulating and motivating admonitions on the theme text, the Philippians 2:14. Do all things without murmurings and disputings. Thank you very much. Would have Brother Jerry close with prayer, and if you just remain seated for a few minutes, we do have a couple of announcements.
Gracious Father in heaven, hallowed be thy name. We thank thee for the admonitions of Paul, the examples of the prophets and apostles. Please keep us humble and teachable. May the medicine and truth and spirit touch our hearts. May it overflow into our lives. May we walk more carefully in Jesus' footsteps. Please forgive us for our shortcomings. Help us to glorify thy name and to bless each other in this convention and in the days and hours that you allow us ahead. We ask and thank thee in Jesus' precious name and merit. Amen.